Thank you very much for the invitation to speak. It's great to be here again. I'm going to describe today work done with Dan Kabat, which is part of a larger program that we've been pursuing. It will be a somewhat technical talk. I want to make sure that you understand that the statement that I will be making are based on computations, so some of the computations. The program that many people here and us have been pursuing for a few years is trying to understand how the bulk emerges from the boundary in the ADS-CFT context. And one of the things you want to understand is how to map certain bulk questions to CFT questions. The reason for that is that once we do that, if we understand the modification of the CFT gives due to its unitarity or some other constraints, we might understand how the bulk properties are changed once you take into effect fact that the Planck constant is finite, so finite n, and we can try and understand these quantum gravity effects that we're interested in. So what I will show today is how one can derive the equation of motion for bulk fields, starting from the CFT correlators. And I will try to work purely from the CFT point of view. I will explicitly show for scalars, interacting scalars. Hopefully, I will get to scalars interacting with gauge fields. And we also did scalar interacting with gravity, but I doubt that we'll have time for that. So along the way, I will also show how the fact that you can have in the bulk field redefinitions that don't change your CFT correlator, how that comes about from the point of view of the CFT. We'll see some more stuff. So the idea here is to try to uplift CFT operators to bulk fields. What we mean by this is to write CFT operators that will mimic bulk fields in the sense that they will reproduce correlation functions in the CFT that one gets from a bulk correlation function in the supergravity. So in the context of a two-point function, this is not so difficult. So let's say one starts with a two-point function in the CFT. And I want to promote this to define some operator such that this will be the supergravity result, which is, we know, to be the power delta, where delta is the dimension of this operator. So this was done in the early days of the ADS-CFT by many people, including people that are here. And the expression that gives the correct thing is can be written as some kind of kernel where this kernel is a known thing. In fact, it's not unique. It solves an equation of motion these are acting on x and z, which is equal to 0, where m squared, as usual, is delta delta minus d. The operator. Since these kind of expression will be, I'll have to write a lot of them, let me just write this as K delta O delta. Epsilon Z, and this just means this expression. Okay. Now, I'm going to go on. So we want to start. Now the operators don't have to be the same one. And this is in the CFT, can be written as some domain K. X minus 1, 1. Delta I plus delta K minus delta K. And then there is X minus 1, 2. Delta I plus delta K minus delta J. And this is fixed by conformal invariance and the dimension of this operator up to a number that could be, in principle, anything.
Question?
Yeah.
Right, so is there a background in which these del squares and so forth are defined? It's pure ADS?
This is pure ADS, yes. Maybe I should have said that. All I'm doing, it will be in pure ADS. And also, I'm working in the Poincaré patch. So I'm working with a metric and actually in everything I would say are you.
So you're not allowing the geometry to fluctuate, or maybe you consider linear perturbations?
So this is the background. I could ask what happens if I look at an operator at the correlation function. Let's say when one of the operators here will be the energy momentum tensor, so that will like be a fluctuation above. So one can do that also. But at the moment, I'm just doing interaction, scalar interaction. You can do that also with interaction with gravity. Okay. So again, we want to promote. We want to be able to write a field, an operator, which would give the bulk result. Okay. So how to do that? Well, but we can start doing something silly. We can just start using this expression, but now inside a three-point function. So at first try, we can just write.
You should tell us what the bulk result is, since those O's are not in the bulk field yet.
Let me not tell you what the bulk result is. You can try to compute this.
Why do you say try? Haven't you written down an operator equation? And it's supposed to be true in any correlation.
So what I wrote here was an operator equation. And this gave the right result in a two-point function. Okay, maybe we're lucky and it gives the right result in a three-point function.
If it's an operator equation, that gives the right result.
No, this is...
But it's going to be the wrong operator equation, yeah. So he's going to have to fix it.
So it's not a systematic procedure.
No, this is an operator equation.
It's the right one.
But it's not the right one.
The wrong one.
It needs to be corrected.
That's why, yeah. So, just a minute, you know, I can label here 0. So this would be... now, this we can compute. We have the form of a three-point function. We have the form this. And this turned out to be a falling expression, which we will need for later, so I'll just write it. So it's a function of chi. Chi is an ADS, it's a conformal invariant combination.
Are you in Euclidean space?
No.
You're in Cartesian space. Okay.
So when I mean squared, I mean in Cartesian space. So whatever the bulk result is, it couldn't be this. Why it couldn't be this? Because the bulk result should obey microcausality. That is, that this operator, whatever it is, if it is in the bulk, and it's, if this point is space-like the boundary points, then this they should commute, so this has to have some analytic properties to give that. And this expression does not have that. This expression actually has a branch cut. If chi is between 0 and 1, but with chi between 0 and 1, the points are still space-like to each other.
Okay, let me just ask the second half of Tom's question.
Okay.
So then there should be I epsilons, which presumably are chosen so that this is a Whiteman function?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm just curious what you had in mind.
Yeah.
Do you mean the Whiteman function, the time-ordered function, which?
I think you mean the Whiteman.
This is the Whiteman function.
It's the Whiteman function.
Okay. So.
Okay. So, however, when you look a little bit close, you see that the non-analytic part of this expression that that contribute to the commutator being on zero, the branch cut, have a form which is quite, is not so complicated, and depends in a certain way on delta I, but not so much on delta j and delta k. And one can try and hope that one is able to cancel the non-analytic terms by maybe adding, to changing the definition of the bulk operator in terms of the CFT. So the idea is to have an improved version, which is following. We had a whole tower of higher dimension operators that will have a non-trivial correlation three-point function with the OJ and OK with certain coefficients. And those coefficients are going to be chosen in such a way that when this expression is put into the three-point function, the result will become analytic . This will be analytic for pi between 0 and 1.
This could be insufficient to determine. The criterion is necessary to be.
True. As we will see, there is more than one way of doing it. But I will actually do the computation. So.
Yeah, but I mean, do we know a priori what that mixed correlator should be?
In principle, you can compute it from the bulk. The bulk itself. But I will show. I will do a computation and then show that it's the right result.
If you tell me what it means, right?
Okay. I will also tell you that.
Okay.
So this was the criterion. So this was the idea in a paper with Kabat and David Lowe in 2011, but it seemed to actually compute the AN wasn't so simple. It didn't look simple. Now, how can you get all these towers of operators? You need an operator that will have a non-trivial three-point function with OJ and OK. So really, the ONs are going to be made out of the OGL case. For instance, one can write an operator like this. One can have some derivatives. And these are chosen in such a way that these operators would be to order, to leading order 1 over n, will be primary operators with certain dimensions. And for each dimension, delta n, which is delta j plus delta k plus 2n, it turns out you can find such expressions.
So the freedom in your choice of phi here is what, basically all these Smerian functions, those could be arbitrary at this point?
Well, we'll show that there's a freedom in actually an.
So what determines the k's? It's the zeroth order condition?
Yeah, k is the same Smerian function that you
use. It's the same all through.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the same all through.
All right. So it's just the coefficients.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I thought you wanted to define phi so that it would have the right answer for any, in any three-point function.
Yeah.
So but you say that you're going to construct it from OJ and OK.
That's right. If it has, let's say phi has just one non-trivial three-point function, which is with phi, some OJ and OK. So I need to add one tower of these. If it has another non-trivial with, let's say, some O, other two O's, I will have to add that tower too. So for each non-zero three-point function, now these are the single trace operators that we're talking about. So for each non-zero three-point function with some two single trace operator, I will have to have a tower of double trace operators made out of these in order to satisfy this condition.
But isn't there a possibility that there will be, things that will interfere with each other?
Not to this
order. In other words, you'll
To this order, no, because to this order, the original one is already order 1 over n,
yeah.
And this one has a 1 over n, but these are going to be order 1, so there can't be any interference. Could be for the next order, if you want this to work also the next order, you might need to work a bit
harder. No, I'm just saying, suppose there is more than one non-zero three-point function.
Mm-hmm.
So you add one tower of operators
right.
to make locality work for that particular three-point function. Now, there's some other three-point function, and I add a different tower of operators because other operators will also contribute
no.
to the... No?
No, because, for instance, let's say you have O, and you have, let's say, O1 and O2, okay?
Yeah. Good.
Now you have also O3 and O4.
Yep.
Okay. Now, okay. So, now to this, I have to add a tower of operator, which are basically O1, O2, and to this, O3, O4.
Right.
Now, if I, instead of here, put an O1, O2 here, okay, since I'm doing linear order in N, the two-point functions here vanishes between O1 and O3 on O4 or O2, so it won't contribute to 1 over N. It will contribute to 1 over n squared, because there is a 1 over n here in front of this. Okay. This has the same order as the original one because of the 1 over n here and the O n.
Okay.
I mean, they contribute order n to the 0.
Would you say this is a leading order consistency check at 1 over n squared then?
Yeah, but we're not doing
it. So you haven't made that check?
No. I have
in terms of that order anyway.
Yeah, you can.
I'm working to order 1 over n. Mm-hmm. There will be a consistent check to 1 over n, but it won't be the one that Thomas did.
So what you're saying is that if I take single trace operators, and I take one pair and I take another pair, none of the double trace operators that appear in the first OPE will appear in the second one to leading order in 1 over n.
Right.
That's the correct. Okay.
Okay, so now, how are we going to determine the AN? So we look at this equation. Oh, I forgot to say what delta star is. So delta star is a half delta I plus delta j minus delta k. Okay, so one needs to write more explicitly what the non-analytic part is that gives rise to the commutator. And so one knows how to do it. There's formulas of what the hypergeometric function, what's the jump across the cut. So basically, what we find that the discontinuous part of this expression can be written as, gamma ijk. There's a 1 minus chi, the d over 2 minus 1. There's gamma delta I minus d over 2 plus 1. There's gamma delta star, gamma delta I minus delta star, gamma 2 minus d over 2, times f delta star minus d over 2 plus 1. 1 plus delta star minus delta I. 2 minus d over 2, 1 minus. So this is the discontinuity that comes from here. And if I have the higher dimensional operator, it's the same expression in which just you have to switch delta I becomes delta n, and delta star is half delta n plus delta j minus delta k. And the gamma ijk are some other constants, c and jk. And so what you really want to satisfy is the following equation. You want the discontinuity for the delta I would be canceled the discontinuity of the delta n. So can you do that? Well, apparently, in certain examples, you can. And I will now give you an example. There are many examples you can do. But I will give you one of them. So the example I'm going to give is we're equal to 3. So we have ADS 4. And we'll start with an operator where delta I is some nu plus 2, where nu is any number that you want. And I pick delta j to be delta k to be L, where L has to be an integer. Okay. So I have a starting three-point function. I have some operator of dimensional delta nu. I have two operators with the same dimension, which is integer, and I want to do this program. Okay. So, plugging all the formulas, the discontinuity from the starting three-point function is some gamma tilde, 1 over 1 minus chi to the 1 half. Gamma of nu plus 3 halves, pi, gamma of nu over 2 plus 1, gamma of nu plus 1 over 2. And now we have this combination of of Legendre functions. Of 1 minus, square root of 1 minus chi, Let me just call this for a moment renew. And the discontinuity coming from the higher dimension operators, delta n, now delta n, which was delta j plus delta k plus 2n, is just 2l plus 2n. And this turns out to be some coefficient, 1 minus chi to the half, some gamma functions. Times a Legendre polynomial, so the Legendre polynomial is only of order even, and actually starts at order 2L minus 2, and we want to satisfy this, so basically we have to be to find the formula in which up to some constants we can write G nu 1 minus chi as a sum over the Legendre polynomial. And it turned out it's possible. It's not very difficult. The Legendre polynomial are orthogonal polynomials. You can just do integrals. The integrals with this and with this are known. So, turns out that one can write this in this fashion. So, k to the infinity, 4k plus 1, 2k minus nu, 2k plus nu plus 1, p to k. Okay, that'll be great, except for a little problem is that we don't have all these Legendre polynomials because we only have n starts at n equal to 0, but the first one that we have is 2L minus 2. But we can manage that in the following way. We have here a somewhat a curious situation that the left-hand side and the right-hand side are all Legendre functions, so they obey, they have the same differential operator, which they're all eigenvalued, they have eigenfunctions of. So, to remind you, all Legendre functions obey this equation. So, for instance, I could act on this equation. Not that I'm saying I'm necessarily allowed to, but I could act formally in this equation with the operator. L to I, where L to I, L mu is just this differential operator. Minus mu equals 1. So if I act with, let's say, L0, it will just kill P0. If I act with L2, it will just kill P2. Etc. And I'll kill all of them all the way up to 2L minus 2. Of course, all the rest would be multiplied by something because this acts on this and this acts on this. But one can do the whole computation and one ends up with the formula that we want. Write it. So after everything is said and done, one can write it as 2 divided by h some h nu, and there's a sum from n equal to 0 to infinity. And here there is some stuff. Okay, there's more stuff here. I won't have room for that. P2n plus 2l minus 2 of n. Okay, so this is the formula, and now we can just read off from that formula what the ans are. And one finds that, well, what I can actually read off is not the an, but the an times the cn jk. If I knew the cn jk, I would know the an. The cn jk actually can be computed, but let me just leave it in this fashion. So this, of course, will depend on what gamma tilde is, up to a constant. But, and there isn't really any way to know what gamma tilde is other than solving the CFT and knowing what gamma tilde is. But we can compute from ADS CFT for some interaction what gamma tilde is and get some expression for it. And so gamma tilde can be computed from ADS CFT. It's just a constant. For instance, from the work of Friedman and Matur and Matusis and Sterling. And when that is used, we get a very nice expression for A and C, which is lambda minus 1 to the n over pi cubed gamma squared L minus 3 halves, n squared n plus L, gamma n plus 2L minus 3 halves, gamma n plus 1, gamma 2N plus 2L minus 3 halves, and 1 over delta N minus 3, minus delta nu minus 3. So this is the expression that you get from this computation, demanding that the expression for the bulk field will obey certain analytic properties. And you may ask, how do I know if that's the right result? Does this agree with anything that we can compute from the bulk? And indeed, there is two ways of checking if this result is correct. One is easy and one is difficult. So I will show you the difficult one.
Are you going to talk about what equation of motion this field satisfies?
That's how I'm going to show you that this is. I haven't shown it. Okay. So one way to see if this expression is correct is to see, to look at the equation of motion that the resulting bulk field satisfies. So we said that the bulk field we'll write as k delta of delta plus 1 over n, sum n equal to 0 to infinity, a n, integral of k delta n, so n. Okay, so at zeroth order, this is just this, which is zero. And now we want to see what the correct equation of motion is. So we act with this on this guy. But remember that all the k's satisfy that L squared of Kn is delta N delta n minus 3, which we'll just call mn squared. This, acting on this, will just give 0, because here this was chosen delta, exactly chosen such that m is delta delta plus 3. And the rest is one gets 1 over n, sum n equals to 0 to infinity, an, mn squared, m nu. So, I have the right notation, minus m nu squared, So this is the equation of motion that this expression satisfies. But how would we know that this is the right one? I mean, this is written as something that is not really recognizable in terms of Bloch terms. So we want to recognize, what is this operator? How do we recognize what this operator is? Well, one way is to put it in some correlation function, compute it, and see what the result is. Okay. So to recognize it, I'm going to put it in correlation function. With OJ of Y1, OK of Y2. So I'm going to compute this correlation function.
Can you not just somehow substitute back in phi, you know, O in terms of phi, and then just see explicitly in terms of phi what it is?
Maybe you can.
You just do the integral and it takes out the term.
I don't think it's so simple.
That's so simple.
You'll see, this is not actually so difficult. The difficult part is that you have to do a sum if you don't know if you can do the sum. But luckily, there's a book with a sum, so this is easy. So, we know what this is. Since we know what the three-point function of any On with OJ and OK is, so we already wrote it, so this is what? This is a sum of n equal to 0 to infinity. This is 1 over y1 minus y2 to the 2 delta j, expression that I erased before. So here to L. Delta j is equal to delta k. Now the sum. And now you have an cnjk, mn squared minus m squared, 1 over chi minus 1, the delta star with index n, f of delta star with an index n, star minus half, delta n minus half, 1 over 1 minus chi. Okay, so you have to do this sum. Actually, this sum doesn't appear in the book, but you can do some massaging. And you can find a sum, and it turns out to be extremely simple. Just this result. And now you can easily identify what this operator is, because this is the bulk to boundary propagator from point x and z to y1 with the dimension operator L, and this is from y2. So this, and this is the correct coefficient exactly to reproduce, and this means that the whole sum an with that mn squared minus mn squared an on is phi j0 phi k0 of znx, where these are just the phi 0 is just k delta j of u and z. Okay? So, What does that mean? That means that with those coefficients that we have computed, the equation of motion, this CFT operator is just lambda over n ij phi k to order 0, which is the right equation of motion. This is just the right equation of motion for a phi cube coupling.
Sorry, so I wasn't paying close enough attention, but to what ambiguities are there in these coefficients?
I haven't gotten to that yet.
Okay.
Now you can ask, why did I get phi cubed coupling? Why didn't I get phi d phi squared coupling or any other coupling that would give me a three-point function in the CFT?
What was lambda again? I'm sorry.
Lambda.
In terms of C, right?
Yeah, no, lambda. Okay. Lambda entered into the expression. There was a gamma tilde, which was the coefficient of the original single trace three-point function. I just put a constant lambda there. So this is agrees exactly with lambda over n phi cubed coefficient. You could have put lambda equal to 1, but we just put lambda. Have it there. So gamma tilde was lambda times some function of delta nu and L, which is a known result from the AES.
J and K there is some.
Again?
J and K of the field.
J and K, yeah.
These are there in the other part of the equation.
This is the equation of motion. Inside phi, the OJ and o, J and K are what are making the ON. So from this, for this to be equal to this, this guy must just be this operator.
But that depends on J and K.
Absolutely.
We're trying to identify an operator independently of J and K.
No. ON are made out of the OJ and OK. Of course, they will be some function.
This is one cubic term that appears in the in the Lagrangian, but there are multiple. There's a phi I, phi j, phi k, c, yeah. I, j, k.
If this was the only, if the only three-point function that you had was some OJ and OK, it would be one cubic coupling in the Lagrangian. If you had more cubic coupling in the Lagrangian, it would
happen. So at the end, the equation of motion has a sum over.
Yeah, it's a sum over J and K.
Yeah. The sum.
Which you didn't write.
No, what sum?
Yeah. If there's more. If there's
okay, but I did just want to. Yeah, if there would be more.
Because on the other half of the equation, you will have the J and K.
Yeah.
Sum, right? No. This is.
Well, he just assumed that the sum
he
was zero.
He just assumed that there was only
one OJ and OK. We made this ON. If there will be another one, there will be another term here with some other OJ and OK. I just gave the example, just having one.
Well, you have the ball, but the ones which have different indices are subleading in 1 over N. That's what you're saying.
No, what I'm saying is that...
Here you have a sum over J and K, but...
You don't have a sum over J and K anywhere.
Yeah, you must.
What?
No. I mean, in the equation of motion for phi, there must be a sum.
It's free, you just zero coefficient.
Yeah.
No, they don't contribute
just
to
just put the sum, it'll make us happy, because the rest of the terms are zero anyway for you.
So. Yeah.
I've assumed that in the CFT, there's only one three-point function between O and some other double trace operator, single trace operator, what I call OJ and OK. If there will be another one, I will have another contribution, and it will be with some of this form, but with some other J and K.
Yeah. But that doesn't change your three-point function. These extra terms affect
the different three-point function
to a subleading.
Leading term, they don't affect.
You answered earlier, right?
They don't affect.
I think everyone understands.
So I could do the sum. It will be okay. 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 So now, where in this do we have some freedom to choose? Well, I already sort of showed you this freedom.
Would this work in the same way if J and K are just equal to the original field?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the restriction here that J and K has to be an integer. So if you take the original field to be an integer, that's fine. If the J and K are not integer, then I don't have orthogonal polynomials, and then the computation is just much more difficult. So.
But then maybe I can't have a three-point function.
Sure. No, I don't think it's just a matter of can I compute.
Okay.
And the example that I'm giving here are examples that I can compute. Otherwise, or not. Okay. So why we have a cubic and not some other interaction? Well, first, remember that to leading or to in order 1 over n, if I have a cubic interaction, let's say, or I have, let's say, some derivative interaction, they're equivalent to 1 over n under a field redefinition. So this interaction would turn, this interaction under a field redefinition to turn to this interaction, but with a different coefficient here. So that's part of the, you always have a field redefinition. And this has to be if the CFT would work, because in the CFT, you only have at this order one parameter, which is gamma tilde. You have no other choices. The three-point function of the CFTs is completely fixed. You have no parameter to play with. So all interaction of this order, if this would be correct, would have to be equivalent to a phi cube interaction, just with different number multiplying liquid. Okay? And this is actually what happened. Now, remember how we got these an coefficient. We wrote an equation, let's say in our example, which was some sum of n, let's say alpha n, and we had this p to n plus 2l minus 2. And the an, c, and k's are computed from this alpha n. But this is not the only equation I can write. I can change the alpha n. For instance, if I act with one of these operators that I said before, let's say L1, it doesn't annihilate anything. It just gives this multiplied by some number. It multiplies these by some number that depends on n. And we'll just get a different equation with some alpha and tildes. And this will give me a different a, n, c, and k. Now, in order to cancel the singularity, it doesn't matter. All any one of these equations are fine. They cancel the singularity because they obey this. But now when I try to sum the contributions, this, what the exact coefficient is important. And the sum would be different, and I would get a different expression. Okay? And that expression, for instance, if I act on this equation by L mu, where mu satisfies nu, mu plus 1 minus mu, mu plus 1 is equal to 2. This equation will turn out to a different equation, and you would get, instead of this interaction, you get a derivative interaction. Okay. So the freedom that you have in order to change some, to cancel the analytic, the non-analytic part, when you sum the whole contribution, gives you a different answer. So, and you can sort of map one-to-one between the field redefinitions that you have to do in order to change one of the interactions to the other, and between the changes in the coefficients A, N, C, and K.
And the dimensions, if you have a modalimetric, what do you compensate the dimensions?
Pardon?
What does compensate the dimensions if you put derivatives?
All derivatives here are dimensionless. I mean, I put r equal to 1, so everything is dimensionless. Okay. Okay. I want to do another example just to show that this is, but this will be briefer, which is the what what happens when you have a scalar field that is coupled to a gauge field in the bulk? Okay, so you want to get the equation of motion, or you want to uplift a CFT operator that is has a non-trivial three-point function, not just with two other scalars, but with some conserved current on the boundary. This is just a slightly simpler example than doing it for gravity, but basically it's the same. And in the paper we did both this and the gravity. But first we have to understand what is the criterion that we need to impose here. Because it's a little bit trickier than with a scalar case. So we want to start with some operator O, which is complex. And it has some non-trivial three-point function with a conserved current. You can also do a non-conserved current, but that's a little bit simpler. And you may want to uplift this. Into some expression written in terms of CFT operator that will have the right bulk expression. But before we used our, as guide, the fact that at space-like separation, things have to commute, so things had to be analytic. But here, this is not so simple because since J is a conserved current, it has some conserved charge on the boundary, so you have some Gauss law. So clearly, in order for Gauss law to be satisfied, this cannot be quite analytic. So we have to find a slightly better criterion. And it turns out, this is a paper with Dan from 2013 and 2012 also, is that the correct criterion for uplifting a complex scalar into the bulk is that the three-point function, but not with the current J, but it's sort of field strength, so we don't use that term. This has to be analytic. And this will imply the correct analytic behavior that one can expect from a scalar field. And so now we want to use this. So again, you can try to write phi of x and z
why is this the right condition?
Okay, I won't have time to explain. But if this is analytic, okay, that means that this will commute with this at space-like separation. It will also commute with this. But the commutation of this with this, space-like separation, does not imply the commutator of this and this being zero, space-like separation.
Right.
And you can check that you can do this. This is a criterion that will uplift this. Now you might ask, is it right or wrong? We gave arguments why it's right, but now I will just do a computation and show you that from this I will get the correct equation of motion.
So is this supposed to be an exact statement or only leading order 1 over n? The fact that the right criterion is that that particular three-point function be analytic.
I think it's exact.
You think it's exact?
Did someone say it commutes up to some Gauss law constraint? Is that's the idea of taking this curl here?
This you want to have a criterion of that something would be, that you can use. Now this is even though you have a Gauss law constraint, this is still correct. This still is analytic. Okay. And there's such an example in the gravity case.
So the thing that bothers me about the statement that it's exact, even if you go back to the scalar case that you talked about before, once I start thinking about gravity, we know what you're going to get in the bulk is some kind of unitary gauge fixed equations in motion. Mm-hmm. And in gravity, when I have fixed a unitary gauge, there are all kinds of non-local terms in the bulk Lagrangian. And therefore, I would expect complicated non-locality in the fields all over the place, even between scalars and scalars, just coming from, you know, higher order exchanges of the non-local terms in the bulk Lagrangian. And so...
Well, this is not exactly true. I mean, when you do canonical quantization of gravity, the commutation relationship of the scalar fields are unchanged. It's true that the commutation relationship between them and some gravity is different, but the commutation relationship between them...
commutators are unchanged, but the commutators in space-like separation aren't unchanged.
Well,
they're not gauge invariant operators in gravity. So that they're, you know, you can't use Lorentz invariants to take equal time to...
That's why I just said in the canonical quantization, the equal time commutators are unchanged. That's true. That's true. And now you might say, okay,
that's
true.
True with the metric.
It does not imply, I didn't say in the metric, I said with the scalar fields with themselves.
I think it's not even true with phi dot.
Well, I'm, yeah.
Sure.
Well, we can... I mean, I'm happy to talk about this more later.
Okay.
Let me just continue.
Yeah, let's not.
With this. Okay. So, okay. So one can try and do the same program as before. let's see. So, okay. So what one can use is the fact that when you compute, you can compute this. So how do we do this? It turns out that this is very similar to the scalar case for the following reason. If you write just O of x for bar of y1 and for mu of y2, this can be written as, so I have factors here that won't matter for the moment. Some derivative operator, L mu nu, acting on this, a result of a three-point function for a scalar of dimension delta, delta plus 1, and d minus 1. So this is a scalar three-point function. And this derivative is 2 minus 1. Of y2 minus u. Okay. And it turned out that one can define scalar operators, but which are not primary, such a way that this has the same form
lot.
Yeah.
When you write mu nu there, those indices are in the boundary.
Yeah.
Because this wouldn't, if you had an index going into the bulk, then it wouldn't be analytic because
that's
there
right.
would be a
combination. Yeah. Mu and nu are in the boundary. Yes.
So I think that's the point, is that this is not the electric field.
Well, maybe mu and nu here.
Yeah.
Are in the boundary.
So that's why. It's because the dressing of phi is the only thing it doesn't commute with at the boundary is the electric field, and that this is not the electric field. So that's why it's analytic.
It's not the radial electric field.
Yeah, it's not the radial electric field.
There's no way. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, it's like the part that's parallel to the boundary. The book that commutes with the choice of dressing here, which is a phi and the boundary.
So since this system is really related very simply to a scalar system, if I am able to cancel the non-entities for the scalar system, I would be able to cancel the non-entities for the scalar coupled to the vector system. If I write this expression, as long as A and F satisfy is related to the scalar result. In some constant that turned out to be minus 4i q over lambda 2 delta minus q. So it turns out that this, if An satisfies this, then the cancellation of the non-elasticity in the scalar case, which I at least showed you an example before, involves the cancellation in this case, and we actually did this scalar computation explicitly and computed the coefficients. But if this is correct, let me now work the equation of motion. This is canceled, and one gets 1 over n sum from n equals to 0 to infinity mn squared minus m squared an f integral k delta n an, which is just equal. Okay. And now again, I want to know what this operator is. So I'll do the same trick as I did before. I will put this operator inside this three-point function instead of this guy and compute it. But I can use now the result that I have here. And so when you do all the sum and everything, this is related to the scalar result of the sum over for the sum that we did before, and which we know how to compute. And this gives the following answer. Computed it in d equal to 3. Well, and now you can ask again, what is the operator that if I put it here in this three-point function will give me this result? And it's not very hard to figure it out. That operator, I won't show you the computation, is, so just right here, the answer is minus 2i q over n g mu nu a mu d nu phi of x and z. So these are the first order smearing function, and g mu and mu nu here are only in the boundary. If you would do this with a non-conserved current, you would get g mu nu, which also includes the z component. So you see that we get the right equation of motion. This is exactly the right equation of motion for a complex scalar field coupled to a gauge field in the bulk. This is the equation of motion to 1 over n. Yeah.
Couldn't you just turn your calculation around? Just write down whatever field equation you want in the bulk, and then solve for the interacting quantum fields using, for example, retarded products.
That's right. That was also done.
In that case, you have your commutation relation as operator statements are manifest. I mean, they're built into the formalism, and then restrict everything to the boundary if you want to. I mean, that should, in some sense, be the same calculation, but just done the other
from
the other way around. Or
that's right. That's right. That's right.
Isn't that a sort of conceptually easier way than figuring out all these sums? I mean, that you may accidentally find in Abram.
I completely agree. The approach that you stated was also used in previously, but it's good to have it as a conceptual thing to see that you can define such a thing. But in practice, I believe that even though this is more difficult in some ways, the other approach, you start getting into trouble asking exactly what these... So here, I wanted to understand what this operator here, in terms of some bulk expression. Yeah. But really, when you want to eventually do some understanding of what is going on at finite end, you want to be able to go from the bulk expression right to the CFT operator, and then it's easier time to manipulate these things. There are all kinds of advantages of writing it this way. Simplicity is not one of them, but there are other advantages. Indeed, you could. You could, in fact, start with the equation of motion in the bulk and solve the equation of motion by with some boundary conditions at the boundary and solve it in. In fact, you could do it more explicitly than it was done before. This is done, again, in our paper. And when you do that, you get exactly the ANCNJKs that I gave before. So you can solve the bulk equation of motion perturbatively and get those coefficients, and they exactly match the coefficient that I've computed just from requiring elasticity of certain three-point.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying, I mean, that way of doing sort of the commutativity that is, seems to be your main guiding principle behind all your calculations,
yes,
is kind of manifest.
That's right.
Whereas here it's sort of a bit mysterious. It seems to depend on all kinds of, you know,
yes,
being able to do certain sums that you can actually solve them, and whereas in that other approach it's kind of...
It's true, but that approach requires you to know the bulk Lagrangian.
Sure, yeah.
The point here is to show that you don't need to do that. Okay, you start with a CFT, and there's a guiding principle that gets you build up the bulk interaction. It's true that you can go the other way, but that requires information that you may or may not have.
I mean, it's also easier. I mean, this is not the easiest way to get the bulk Lagrangian, right? I mean, you can just look at boundary correlation functions and match them to find the wind diagrams. I mean, to find the cubic term, just look at the CFT three-point function. You don't need to do anything fancier. And just look at the coefficient, and that's the coefficient of this cubic.
But that way will not give you an expression for a bulk field. That will just give you...
No, that'll give me the equation of motion, and then I do what you said to get the expression for a bulk field.
Well, I didn't say you cannot do that. It's true that you can do that, but you have to, I think, make assumptions about the bulk.
The point
of this is to show you can do it from the CFT point of view.
Yeah.
It's true that you can do it from the bulk point of view, now that we know that there is ADS CFT. But I think that the approach just... more intrinsic CFT approach has its advantages, and I just showed that you could actually follow this program and do that.
The zeroth order expression for a bulk operator, you can get it. can you get it in cases without any symmetries in the bulk and without solving the free equation of motion in the bulk? Can you also use this kind of commutativity?
Not that I know.
So you do have to solve the free bulk equations of motion to get the zeroth order expression.
The free?
Yeah.
Okay. That's one way of doing it.
Is there another way?
Well, in empty ADS, it really is a symmetry.
That's when you have symmetry.
But in other situation...
For the higher order terms, the only thing you used was microcausality between bulk points and boundary points. Why is that sufficient? Why didn't you need microcausality between bulk points and bulk points?
Well, so let's look at the simple case of the scalar. So, let's say I have a bulk scalar here, and I'll just draw the region on the boundary that this is smeared on. Okay? This involves them. In this expression, some complexifying boundary, but doesn't matter, something. Now, so if I have some points here, this commutes with any local operator here. Okay? If I want to promote this guy inwards, I will smear it in such a way, like this. If all these points on the boundary are contained with this, the region that this was already commuting with it, then this will trivially commute, right? Of course, if I now make up a point which is here, so the smearing is only partially in this case, then these will not commute with this, so this and this I cannot say it commutes or not. But if I have if I promote the bulk, the scalar field, into the bulk by smearing over a region which was made out of points which were spaced like to this guy, then I can understand that this will still work.
Related question, I mean, can't you do this same problem with two of the boundary operator replaced by bound fields? One hole, right, and replace it with a
just more complicated.
Yeah, and you don't think you get extra constraints, I mean, in particular this one.
No, at
you,
in
you
fact
pull down two, yeah.
No, in fact again, to 1 over n, the expression that one writes for two bulk fields and one boundary operator is still okay.
Just switch it.
For the scalar case. In the other cases, it's a little bit more complicated, so I cannot say it. But for the scalar case, it's very simple to see. So,
that's it. What about checks at higher order and then, you know, higher point function, so to speak? Just haven't looked?
Yeah, we're starting to look now. I mean, it took a while to, you know, work out everything even into this order, and we hope it will take less for higher order.
Yeah, I guess there's a question of whether you expect more non-trivial consistency conclusions there. Vis-a-vis the...
I would expect so. I mean, unlike the three-point function, which was basically fixed, the four-point function has, you know, a whole function of something, and I don't know, until we do it, we don't know.
I mean, the consistency is guaranteed if ADS-CFT is correct. So the only way that this will fail is if ADS-CFT is wrong. And of course, it could be, but just we should adjust our priors.
Well, but the question is it sufficient? Is it enough just to demand that, or you will have more freedom than just free limitation, let's say? I think not.
By ADS-CFT, I mean that the local correlation functions in the boundary theory are equivalent order by order and 1 over n to Feynman Wynn diagrams from some bulk Lagrangian. That's what I mean by ADS-CFT being correct. If that's true, then we follow the procedure suggested by this gentleman, and it's guaranteed to work. So the only question is whether that statement is true or not. And if we're interested in testing that statement, forget about the bulk operators. Let's just think about the boundary correlators and see if we can falsify it at that level already.
Personally, we feel that this should be good. The reason, however, that we're doing it this way, again, I mean, it's not... Once you understand it, you can get it from the bulk equation of motion. So again, you know you can get it. But eventually, let's say, you would actually want to know something they didn't know before. Right?
I mean, sure.
We hope. So for instance, you look at the equation of motion. If we understand, for instance, that at for some reason, at finite, I mean, we know that, for instance, at finite end, the CFT cannot have as the same Hilbert space as interacting local fields in the bulk. So, for instance, one can imagine a simple scenario in which there is some cap on the highest dimension primary operator that you can get. Not that I'm saying that it happens, but clearly there isn't as many as you expect from a local bulk. That means that in the sum that I've just done, I would have to put some n max. That clearly would change the equation of motion. I won't get any more now phi j, phi k, and znx. I would get them plus some non-local corrections that I would be able to compute explicitly now that we know what the coefficients are and, you know, how things are working. So this is the reason why we're doing it. I mean, the fact that in principle you could, you know, solve the bulk equation of motion and do everything is okay, but we eventually want to get to the point where we can understand something that is beyond the perturbative supergravity.
Do you have the analogous
analyticity conditions for, are they easy to see for the coupling to gravity or an abelian?
Yeah. So, okay, it turns out.
Well,
so again, so gravity, you start, you have some O, and you have T mu nu. And again, this cannot really be commuting. You might ask, what is the circularity? So at the moment, we have a criterion, but it only works for D bigger equal to 4. I don't know why, but this is what we found, which is that Ox of Y1, C alpha beta gamma delta Y2 is analytic. Where this is the Weyl tensor, but all the indices have to be different. So that's why we need at least D. I know. And when you do this, and you do the same procedure, we find the right equation of motion. In the gravity case, we just find, G, well, basically H mu nu, D mu, D mu phi, with the right coefficient here, that is exactly the right thing in holographic gauge. So, in D again.
Is the Weyl of this T? What do you mean the Weyl? The Weyl of this T?
The Weyl tensor composed of this. So the Weyl tensor is some.
If T was
this is D alpha, D beta, D.
Yeah,
yeah. As if T was the magnetic. Yeah.
But the point is that you have to only work with like transverse gravitons. You can't get messed up with the longitudinal parts.
Right. These are all
Those are all boundaries.
These are on the boundary. I mean, when I say a Weyl, I mean.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm just doing some derivatives on the T.
I know.
In the case might correspond to, you say, to having physical gravitons in the boundary.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Because like when you took the curl of J, that's a very strange thing to do. But what you're really doing is. You're saying I don't care about the longitudinal part of J. Because you explained that because of Gauss's law, there's going to be something that complicates the analyticity property. So you only want to ask a question about the interaction with the transverse degrees of freedom. Isn't that what's going on?
It could be. I don't know if that's. It certainly looks like that, but I don't know if that's the answer.
Can I ask a question going in the other direction? What about D equals 2? So you get, then you don't have all this transverse stuff, but you have a simpler CFT. Did you look? Is there anything?
You mean with a vector conservative charge?
No, just anything. The whole program with.
We did D equal to 1, D equal to 2, D equal to 3, D equal to 4, D equal to 5. So we have example, just didn't show it.
Special to be learned from D equals 2.
In the scalar interaction, no. In the vector interaction, well, D equal to 2 is special because there the theory in the bulk is actually a Chern-Simon theory, not a Maxwell theory. So things have different structures. This is why I did the example in D equal to 3. So this is a little more familiar.
Yeah. I mean, there's an analog of the Weyl tensor in three dimensions called the Bach tensor.
Okay.
So that would be something to try. I think, if this
yeah.
is.
No, I mean, analog. You know, when we did this, we got this, and now that we see that we get the right equation of motion, we have more motivated to try to solve the D equal to 3 case again.
Because, I mean, the actual Weyl tensor vanishes identically in any three-dimensional space-time, but there's another tensor which tells you when the space is conformally flat.
I see. Yeah, so maybe that one.
It's not the Cotton tensor?
York
tensor, maybe? Isn't it all different? It's a derivative of
the
three-index
tensor.
Yeah.
I
think it's all the same thing.
I mean, you have to try. I mean, we try things, and this is one way it works. You know, so it's not.
I mean, there is a principled way to derive that, though, since it's presumably true, which is that you look at the gravitational Dirac brackets in the bulk to leading order in 1/n, and argue that bulk fields are given that.
I think this is simple.
You just made it up. You just said, if this is true, I get the right answer. That's not totally satisfactory logic, right?
Okay, so I have to say, this is not the... I didn't say how we got that. I mean, I just said that we got that without knowing this is the right answer to the equation motion. This is something we had before from other considerations. I mean, First, the Weyl tensor is very is natural to think, because even when you look at a two-point function, T mu nu of x, T alpha rho of x and z, of course, they don't obey any kind of elasticity condition. They don't commute, but the C do obey that. And then, but this is with any indices. But then when you go to the three-point function, you see that the structure becomes very complicated. And what happened is that when these are all different, this is again can be written as a differential operator acting on a scalar three-point function. That makes life so simple. And I'm not saying that that's a guiding principle, but this is this was enough to reconstruct the
block. I mean, isn't the nice property that the Weyl tensor transforms homogeneously under gauge transformations around ADS?
Yeah, I'm just saying, I mean, the Weyl tensor is not so hard to figure out why it's here. I mean, there aren't that many options. I mean, the Riemann tensor, for instance, doesn't work if you do this even for the two-point function. The Weyl tensor does, and then go on and try to see what you can do.
So is your statement that if you have this Weyl tensor three-point function where the indices are not distinct, the result is definitely not analytic, but just that it's messy and it's easier to look at this case?
It's very unclear to me that you can make it analytic by adding higher dimensional operators, you see? You have to be able to make, it's not analytic, right? The thing is, can you make it analytic by adding higher dimensional operators, okay? And the structure...
After you fix up the three-point functions with all different indices in the Weyl tensor, that does not automatically make the...
That's not analytic, no. It's not analytic, it's just that I can have a higher dimension.
After you add those terms to make those three functions analytic, do you know that the other three-point functions that involve Weyl tensors with coincident indices are still not analytic?
I cannot do that computation because in order to do the integrals, I know you know what they are. I have to be able to do the integrals, and I cannot do those integrals. They're even the integral for the scalar field is not so trivial. It took a while now to figure out how to do it. And things that don't fall into that are even more difficult, and we don't really know what to do. So I don't know what the answer is.
But shouldn't it be analytic? I mean, I'm not sure I process everything, but from the bulk point of view, wouldn't ADS-CFT tell you that you still have microcausality for those boundary operators?
Certainly not, right. I mean, there's no reason there's a Gauss constraint, right? Now,
yeah, but the Gauss constraint didn't affect the Weyl tensor, right? Because the Weyl tensor is the part that doesn't couple with zero.
I don't know if
this is correct. I don't see this book point of view why the index structure on the Weyl tensor should matter. As you say,
I don't know.
The Weyl tensor versus the Riemann tensor is clear.
No, but that's clear here. But in the three-point function, for instance, if you gave the commutation relationship between the bulk field and the gravity, and then I know all the expression, which we don't really know in holographic age, then you could ask if this is the right criterion. But since we don't know how to write it, you need to solve the canonical quantization holographic gate, it's not so simple, and then also figure out if it's true at space like the curve. I'm not saying cannot be done, I'm just saying I don't know how to do it.
Other questions? Okay, thanks again.